Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How has our understanding of autism advanced in recent years? And is the growth in scientific knowledge keeping pace with the rapid rise in autism diagnoses? Last month, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimated that as many as 1 in 68 American children is on the autism spectrum. Since April is National Autism Awareness Month, we wanted to talk about how autistic brains work and learn what experts believe needs to be done to help those on the spectrum learn and grow to their full potential. Dr. Pamela Rollins is Associate Professor in the School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences at the University of Texas at Dallas. Kathy Boatman is a Child Development Specialist and Board Certified Behavior Analyst at Children's Medical Center, and she lectures at UTD. Welcome both of you to Think.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to start with this new CDC estimate of 1 in 68. That's a 30% increase in 2 years. How much about that is more kids on the spectrum, and how much is about more adults knowing what to look for?
It's a combination of both. Mm-hmm. I would say there's been a lot more awareness about signs of autism. It's certainly very trendy in the media right now. And some of these children might have been diagnosed with something different 30 years ago. So you're seeing better diagnosis, more concise, and you're also seeing an actual, you know, increase.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a study out of California that estimates about 27% of the rise is due to that diagnostic substitution and really opening up the spectrum to the higher end, which happened really in 1994. And most of it is really due to unknown genetic and environmental causes and the combination between. But there's definitely a very heritable link to it.
Well, there was a story last month that found that it appears that some brain changes begin in the womb for people who will have autism later on. Can you give us some perspective on that?
I know that they have found some differences in hormonal differences. They have found some differences in brain volume, but they still have a lot of research to do.
I think what you're referring to is Eric Corshane's research from University of San Diego. And he actually presented this in Texas about a year ago. He is looking at the brain layers, and there are 7 brain layers that are developed in utero. And he's looking at hormonal changes in those brain layers. And what he's found is patches, so disorganization, not throughout the brain, but specifically in the frontal lobe, which is where we do most of our cognition and our thinking, and the temporal lobe, which is where we do our language, where that's from. And so that really needs to be replicated, but there's very, very strong evidence there that it's something that's starting prenatally. And what he says, which is also very important, that if it's starting so early, that really, really means we need to have early identification mm-hmm. so we can start having treatment, because early identification and early treatment is what is going to help mitigate the effects of autism.
So currently, how early can autism be reliably diagnosed?
Reliably diagnosed, they typically say 18 to 24 months. People have been saying that for quite a while now for someone who really understands autism. Some people are beginning to say 14 months, but really by 18 months. However, with that said, okay, there are about 20% of children who are not showing the signs at 18 months, but they're showing them at 24 months. Mm. So if you pass a screening at 18 months of age, it's really important to get screened again at 24.
And a lot of parents who have children with an autism diagnosis will tell you they saw signs much earlier than 18 months. The well child exams at your pediatrician will do an ages and stages questionnaire. Hopefully they're utilizing the social emotional portion of that. That will pick up on some of those earlier signs. And then I believe they do the MCHAT questionnaire or the PEDS at 18 months to help screen all children at their well child exams.
AAP, the American Academy of Pediatrics, recommendation is to do a developmental screening at 9, 12, 18 and 24. And so that would be the ages and stages. And to do a specific autism screening at 18 and 24 months. And some pediatricians really aren't sure what the difference is between a developmental screening and an autism-specific screening. So there's issues there, and getting people to screen is sometimes difficult.
So I suppose it's important for parents maybe to be proactive and say, are you checking just to see that they're hitting milestones, or are you checking specifically for autism? Is that a worthwhile question?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. When we talk about a spectrum, boy, the spectrum here is so wide. Can you speak about the variations and then what all people who are diagnosed on the autism spectrum, in fact, do have in common?
Well, we have a saying that when you've seen one autistic individual, you've seen one autistic individual because it's very, very varied. And the new diagnostic classification, I personally like for a lot of reasons, because what it's looking at is the core features, what makes a person be on the spectrum. And that is difficulties with social interaction and social communication, and difficulties with repetitive behavior or restricted interests of activities. And in that one is also a sensory problems would be going into that one. That's the core. Around that, you can now be described as, do you have a language problem or do you not have a language problem? Do you have intellectual disability or not have intellectual disability? Do you have comorbidities of attention deficit disorder or some other kinds of things? So it's really allowing us to describe what that variation is while seeing what that core feature is at the same time.
So now, instead of hearing that someone has autism versus Asperger's, you're going to have autism spectrum disorder, and you're going to have a level 1, 2, 3 of severity of all of those features.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual essentially eliminated the term Asperger's, but that doesn't mean that people who had been previously diagnosed don't have a condition. It simply means that they're now under this broad umbrella of autism spectrum disorder. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
There used to be several terms. There used to be several disorders, autistic disorder, Asperger's, and PDD-NOS, pervasive developmental disorders not otherwise specified, and childhood disintegrative disorder, which was very rare. And what we found clinically, especially, people were really reliable on whether or not someone was on the spectrum or off the spectrum, but were not reliable within those categories. Mm-hmm. So the categories became meaningless. A lot of people with Asperger's are very upset to lose that classification. Those people will now be classified as having autism with high intelligence, with good language, and perhaps no comorbidities and very high functioning. And if they want to call themselves Asperger's, that's okay too, mm-hmm. you know?
So, all right, so let's talk about what treatments and therapies typically consist of. And I recognize if you say you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. But what kinds of behaviors are addressed? What kinds of sort of processing deficiencies would be addressed with therapy?
There are so many treatments for autism now, and they're doing a lot of research to pick out which treatments are more effective and evidence-based. And I really encourage people to look at, the research on the treatments that they're looking into. It's really important for our kiddos who have language issues to get speech therapy. Behavior therapy is an important part to help reduce any behaviors that are interfering with learning and functioning, and to help with skill development. And then we have social skills groups that help them integrate their skills in with their peers and help those social communication delays.
Talk a little bit about what it feels like to be on the autism spectrum based on people that you've worked with, because I think for people outside of that world, it can be difficult to sort of ironically put the shoe on the other foot and imagine what it feels like to have an autistic brain.
I would imagine it would feel very isolating, and it would probably depend on what skills you do have. Mm-hmm. Imagine not being able to communicate with those around you and communicate your needs and have your needs met. Not being able to connect to some of the people that love you in typical ways. So I can imagine there is a lot of frustration and a lot of just feeling like not understanding what's going on around you and what people are saying to you.
And walking in, if you have sensitivities, right? So you might walk into a room and not know if there's going to be a loud noise. And so it's going to be scary to walk into a room you've never been into. Or if someone touches you, they might touch you in a way that is going to feel like they're really hurting you when they're not hurting you. And so that becomes really scary. And not understanding the world, there's a theory called weak central coherence, which suggests that individuals with autism is sort of, I call it the forest through the trees. They see all the trees, but they don't get the gist.
Yeah.
And so when you walk into the room and you see lines rather than windows, it's very scary until someone helps you create the gist. So really processing the world in a very, very different way. But every individual with autism is different. So you really need to do a really good evaluation to understand each child's strengths and weaknesses and developmental level and really start treatment at their developmental level and use their strengths to get at their weaknesses and to go on like that. I will say with all of this that most of the I've been working with individuals with autism since 1982.
Wow.
And most of the individuals I've met are really loving people mm-hmm. and have really wonderful hearts. It's just connecting to them in their way to find that out.
So there is therapy that parents might seek out on their own for their child in a medical situation. Then there is the question of schools. How well equipped are schools to cope with the growing number of children who show up and have autism and need to be educated?
That's a big topic. Mm-hmm. I think schools are getting better at working with these children. Certainly your schools that have more funding are able to provide, say, better communication tools for our kiddos who are not verbal communicators. They're able to provide more training for their teachers on managing behavior issues. But I think that those groups are getting larger and larger, and there's probably a sense of overwhelmment by the school district.
Mm-hmm. I will say that I'm on the Texas Council for Autism and Pervasive Developmental Disorders and also on the state Autism State Planning Grant. So I meet with agency people from all different health and human resource agencies as well as different professors from all over the state who work in autism. And the state's very diverse, and there's a lot of areas in rural areas and underserved populations that we have no services whatsoever. Hmm. And it's really very sad. And this council right now is trying to ask the legislation for some money so that we can really identify who's out there and do a better gap analysis of services. We are also calling for building capacity, both in pre-service training for teachers, not just special ed teachers, but regular school teachers, mm-hmm. because children are being mainstreamed, and that's really important that it's not just throwing a child into a classroom. They need the certain supports when they're in that classroom. And then also in-service training.
We're speaking this hour with Dr. Pamela Rollins, Associate Professor in the School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences at the University of Texas at Dallas, and Kathy Boatman, Child Development Specialist and Board Certified Behavior Analyst at Children's Medical Center, also a lecturer at UTD. April is National Autism Awareness Month. If you've got a question, call us now at 1-800-933-5372, send email to think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. SMU.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Kathy Boatman, child development specialist and board-certified behavior analyst at Children's Medical Center and also a lecturer at UTD, and also with Dr. Pamela Rollins, associate professor in the School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences at the University of Texas at Dallas. April is National Autism Awareness Month, and we want to take your calls and answer your questions at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. How is it that some people, I suppose, on the higher end of the spectrum or higher functioning end of the spectrum, don't get diagnosed until later in life? Some of them are adolescents. Some of them are even adults when they discover that they have these issues.
They are high functioning and they're not exhibiting some of the maladaptive behaviors. They don't have language delays. It's really easy to miss and just think of some of their behaviors as being quirkier. He likes to be alone. He doesn't really like to play, you know, with other kids or something like that. So it can really easily go without, as long as it's not disruptive to others or he's making good grades in school. Sometimes that they won't really look into, you know, a diagnosis or that there's anything going on.
Do those individuals still benefit from being diagnosed and seeking out some therapy?
I have met adults who, once they have found out that they were Asperger's, it really helped them understand themselves. Mm-hmm. They really were like, oh, that's why I'm like that. And then it just opened up a door for them.
Hmm. Do the manifestations of autism along the spectrum change, say, at adolescence when you've also got this surge of teenage hormones to deal with?
Definitely. And unfortunately, until the Affordable Care Act, insurance only covered autism services till about the age of 10, right before you hit puberty. Yeah, the issues with autism definitely change at that point. You're starting to work on adaptive living skills, trying to become an independent adult. The consequences of your actions can be much greater than they were when you were younger. So there's a whole new scope of things that they can benefit from in therapy. Also, when they graduate from school, if they've spent the last 12 years with a whole group of the same kids and they've developed some relationships and they know the person and they kind of have a little network, then when, just like anyone, when you graduate from high school and either move on to college or get a job, you have to start new relationships. Nobody knows you anymore. And that's very hard for some of these kiddos. So they really can benefit from more social skills therapy, even at that age.
Mm-hmm. And transitional planning, transition to the next stage. And that really has to start really around 14. What's going to happen? Where are you going to go? What kind of job are you going to have? What can you do? How do you become a functional adult? And because learning can be hard and people have different issues, what kind of supports are going to be needed? So that really has to start happening.
We've heard from a number of people on social media who want to know if it's possible to sort of stop the increase in cases, particularly those that are not related to, I guess, better diagnosis, but that do seem to be an overall growth in the number of people within our society who have to deal with this.
Unfortunately, we don't really know what causes it.
Mm-hmm.
We look into genetic and environmental variables, and there's not definitely one answer for that. But I know that they are doing a lot of research to find out what can be done to prevent the diagnosis.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Alex in Dallas. Hello, Alex.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
I just had a question. When I was about 13, I got a partial diagnosis, or I don't know if it's full diagnosis or not, as being autistic, or at least having a lot of the characteristics for it. And I was just wondering what that turns out to be as far as adults are concerned. I don't know, that's really an open-ended question, but just interested to know what it means. I'm fully socially functional, but I have mild case of OCD, and I was wondering if that might be related to it, or, you know, just not being able to get your brain to stop talking.
OCD can definitely be an overlapping feature, but the one of the primary parts of the disorder is social communicative issues. So if you feel like you may really not have the diagnosis, I would certainly encourage you to maybe be tested again. Or are you feeling like that you really don't have the diagnosis?
Just confused a little bit because, you know, the my perception of autism is the, you know, the really bad cases where people are not communicative and, you know, antisocial and all of those things.
How old are you now?
9.
Sorry, say that again, Alex?
29.
29.
So if you have the diagnosis or you don't have the diagnosis and it isn't interfering with your life, you don't feel like it is a problem in your social interactions, you're able to live independently and hold down a job, and you don't feel it's interfering, then you know that it's there, but it's not really making that much of a difference for you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think we have the answer to that. It makes perfect sense. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Jessica in Dallas. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I had more of a comment versus a question. But my question to you is, earlier we were talking about therapies that are recommended for autism, and I'm actually an occupational therapist. And I heard, you know, that the recommended therapy was speech therapy and behavioral therapy, but I didn't hear anyone mention occupational therapy to work on all of those sensory processing issues that so many of the children with autism are dealing with. And, you know, a lot of those behaviors from the children that I work with are actually stemmed from being overstimulated and having those significant sensory sensitivities, or the complete opposite, just being completely under-aroused by sensory input. And so what we're doing at the clinics is really working on making sure they can effectively regulate themselves and register that input so they can move effectively in the classroom or on a playground or in those social settings.
Well, thanks for your call, Jessica.
You're absolutely correct. I'm sorry I left occupational therapy out. That is definitely a key feature of a comprehensive therapy intervention program.
And I completely agree. I think when we oftentimes when we I know as a speech pathologist, when I say behavioral therapy, people are thinking that I mean applied behavioral analysis. But a behavioral therapy being something that's not a medicine, something that you're not taking. And I consider occupational therapy one of the evidence-based behavioral therapies that are out there. And I really, really appreciate your call because what you do is very, very important. And I know that also working with occupational therapists and having a team approach that everyone needs to be on the same team when we're working with these kids is really important. So thank you so much for your call.
And I guess, am I correct about this? Ideally, you're transitioning from maybe modifying a child's environment so that it is not very stressful to helping that child get to a place where they can tolerate sort of real-world conditions.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes, it's exactly what you said, and the way that I like to practice and a lot of developmental people like to practice is take the actual natural environment that they're in and figure out ways to make it less chaotic and more understandable so that you're putting more supports into that environment so the child's functioning in their natural environment, and then as they do better, to begin to withdraw those supports. So it's a little different.
So they can become more adaptive to new environments.
We have an email here from Natalie who has a question about long-term prognosis for kids on the spectrum. She asks, what kinds of options for independent living exist for adults on the spectrum?
There are many, usually at the end of the high school year. They do transition planning. They do a lot of adaptive life skills training to help them become independent if they need to learn how to use public transportation or if they need to learn some job skills, how to apply for jobs. What we do need more of is in the business community more opportunities and more kind of scaffolding between high school and businesses, and let businesses know what, you know, what these kiddos can offer and how they can benefit their business. I know that the ASAN, the Self-Advocacy Network for Autism, they even provide, they work a lot with businesses to try and provide jobs for graduates that have autism, and they offer, you can send your resume in and they'll try and help you out with a job. You can also go to the Texas Rehabilitative Commission, the Vocational Rehabilitative Group, and they assist in helping to find a job and to help people become more independent livers.
But the issue about independent living or living for adults is actually a national crisis. And it's a crisis in Texas. We don't have enough places for adults to go, and it's a national crisis. We're very lucky we have Anna Hunley in Dallas, who's the executive director of the Autism Treatment Center, and she's on the national scene on trying to find new ways to find housing for individuals with autism.
Something that's between, I gather, fully institutionalized care and just having your own apartment somewhere.
Right. Mm-hmm. And especially here in Texas, we're really trying to get people out of the state schools and into their communities and giving them the supports they need. There's some waivers to help people live. If anyone's out there has a child with autism, the first thing that they need to do is to get yourself on a waiver list, because their interest list is about 10 years right now. And so you might not need it now, but you want it there when you need it. But we're trying to get more people into community settings and to create more community settings.
What kind of supports are available for parents who, depending on where their child falls on the spectrum, may have a lot more on their plate than people with neurotypical kids?
There's a lot of support groups out there. There's the Families for Early Assessment and Treatment. Families for Early Autism Treatment. It's FEAT. There's Autism Now. There's a lot of support groups. Your local Autism Society is a very great support. Mm-hmm. Getting involved in the support groups does a couple of things. You learn from other people who have already negotiated through the school system and through the medical system and getting treatment for their child. So they have a lot of resources for you to find out what can be helpful for you and your family and your child.
It's a really difficult maze to navigate. And one of the things, everything she said is absolutely correct. There's also the Texas Autism Research and Resource Center website that has a lot of information for all kinds of things autism. It's sort of the portal. We're trying to put everything together to help parents to find therapies, to find housing, to find information that the state is putting together. And that's a really good resource.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Julie on the line now in Allen. Hey, Julie.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We've been navigating this since my son was about 13. He's shown symptoms as a child, but they were so minor that they were overlooked. And when we moved to Texas in 13, when he was 13 is when things really took a nosedive, and he did attempt suicide. Fortunately, we came through that and a couple other attempts along the road. He's 19 now, and I did have to quit working in June of 2011 to care for him. Because it was either that or to admit him somewhere. We've been navigating the system here in Dallas for about 4 years now, 5 years, and have had a really traumatic experience, even being turned away from Timberlawn. Mm-hmm. and it was a very bad situation. So we are now moving to California. I don't work. I am getting a divorce. And there's no resource. There hasn't been anything here. He has a wonderful therapist right now who's actually saved us quite a bit. I'll just throw his name out there because he's been so terrific. It's Dr. Mandel at AAA Mental Health in Richardson. But his other doctors and stuff really haven't been able to give us the resources.
Well, Julie, I so appreciate your call, and thank you for telling us your story. I can hear her frustration and her concern for her son. How awful to think that you can't stay in the place that has been your home because you can't access the proper care.
It's the truth, especially as they get into adolescence and older, where a lot of focus is put on the young children. I know that's where my research is, and about early identification, but we don't have enough resources to go around for adolescents and adults. And it is very sad. And I think that the caller also brings up the financial burden on the families. There's recently been a study that said on average, and that's sort of the middle, families who have children with autism spend about $18,000 more on caring for their child than a child with another disability. And that doesn't include the hidden cost that the caller also talked about. Many of the parents are underemployed or not employed because they need to be the person
available.
They need to be available. They need to bring the child from one therapy to the next therapy and make sure that nothing terrible happens. And so that's also a big burden on society.
And that's another thing the Affordable Care Act has done, is that extending that age for insurance coverage of autism treatment so that they can continue to have coverage for the treatment to help alleviate some of those costs.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number if you want to talk to us. We are having a conversation today with Pamela Rollins and Kathy Boatman, both experts in autism, because April is National Autism Awareness Month. You can also send email to think@kera.org or drop me a line on Twitter. I am at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Kathy Boatman of the University of Texas at Dallas, and she's also a child development specialist and board-certified behavior analyst at Children's Medical Center. Dr. Pamela Rollins is here as well. She's associate professor in the School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences at the University of Texas at Dallas. If you've got a question, please call us at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org. Or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. We hear there from Robert, who sends a tweet saying, check out NPITX.org. They hire people on the autism spectrum to do computer programming. It's an amazing place. I haven't checked it out myself, but if you're curious, maybe you can take a look.
What a great resource. Yeah. Thank you.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Maxine in Dallas. Hey, Maxine. Maxine, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Okay, sure. Go right ahead.
Thank you. Here's my question. I have a granddaughter who's 16 years old. She's a very bright girl, and she has been diagnosed with Asperger's. She's in the process of starting to look at colleges. She has some friends, not many, one or two. So the question becomes, should she be looking at schools away from home? How far? Should she stay at home for college? She's in a position to do that. What's been your experience?
Tough questions for any teenager.
Yes, that is a tough question. Well, I guess it would kind of depend on whether any of those friends are going to the same college. It would be nice for her to kind of stay around either at home with where she has a social network outside of school if she doesn't have anybody going with her. But, I mean, it just kind of depends on her skills. Is she good at making – at initiating friendships? Is she good at seeking out people and getting involved in groups and helping herself as far as making those connections, then I think it would be fine for her to go away. But I do think that kids going to college, especially in those first couple of years, need some kind of social support.
Which leads into it's important to talk to the school to find out what their disability services are like. Several schools have really, and UTD actually has really good disability services for people who are on the spectrum. And there's support groups and also someplace to go if there's a problem. I'm having problems negotiating this situation. What do I do? How to interact with your professors, which can be difficult, and a whole host of things. So what you really need to do is how far away from home is she comfortable going? That's hard for all kids, and or many kids, I should say. And then what's the disability services like in that school? So
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Fort Worth. We have Trish on the line. Hi, Trish.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I'm loving this show. My son is 7 and on the spectrum in first grade. So all of this, I'm just absorbing like a sponge. I had two questions that are, I guess, somewhat related. One is because he is on the spectrum, I found various blogs by other autism parents and then also by autistic adults, which became a huge resource for me. And I was wondering if the non-autistic autism professional community has been, like you ladies, kind of delving into that and using that as a resource to make more inroads in terms of treatment. And then is there a career path to become that transitional person from school into businesses? Because I would love to do that. I see that on the horizon for my son as being something that might be a challenge. And if I could be one of the people that blazes the trail, get businesses to understand what a resource that they might be missing because they're a little quirky. Hmm. I would be thrilled to find that path.
Well, Trish, it sounds like there would be a need for someone doing that sort of work. But ladies, do you have any ideas, any thoughts?
So I would definitely get involved with your local Autism Society group. And I'm sure that they have initiatives within their group that work with businesses. And you would be a great model for that type of a program to help, get connected with some businesses and get those networks started. And definitely start now. You've got about 10 more years for your child.
What do you suggest to families that may have one child on the spectrum and another child who is neurotypical, and maybe there are two different, if not sets of rules, sets of conditions for when things happen and how things happen, and how do you suggest that families negotiate that? Does that make sense?
Siblings are hard. Mm-hmm. They have to learn that they're different. I have a student in my class who did a thing on a lecture on siblings, and to realize that her older brother, could get away with things that she couldn't get away with, and feeling stigmatized sometimes because she always had her brother with her, and so she also became the person who wasn't interacting with people, and just having that sensitivity. She finds, and there's more and more support groups for siblings, and that's really important because they have their own set of family dynamic issues. So that's, I think, looking for those support groups. And there's camps for siblings, and there's more of those things now than there used to be.
And at a younger age, if they are at home a lot and don't have a lot of exposure to other kids, you can actually see typically developing kids pick up some autistic type behaviors from their sibling. And then sometimes you don't find out that, they may be typically developing until they get into a school setting where they're with other children and they're picking up other social cues and that kind of thing. So it's an important thing to think about at the younger ages.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Julie on the line now in Aubrey. Hi, Julie.
Hi. I wanted to ask if you're familiar with the method of helping children with autism called TEACH, used by the University of North Carolina Medical School in North Carolina.
Yes, TEACH is a wonderful program. I think they've been around forever. I've been in the field for over 30 years, and they're really were with us all along. So there's a lot of being very structured, pre-organizing to help allow the child to be independent, using visual supports that a lot of other programs have taken from the TEACH model. And so they've really infused the fields very nicely with supports and skills and practices that's been very helpful for everyone.
And it's one of the evidence-based practices that is recommended for intervention with children with autism.
Help us understand that, because I think a lot of well-meaning parents may go to someone who is purportedly an expert on this sort of thing that may or may not be relying on evidence-based practices. What does that term mean exactly, and how do you find out what truly works?
To be evidence-based practice is actually there's a scientific evidence, which is what some of what we're talking about, but it's not just scientific evidence. But let me go to the scientific evidence first.
Okay.
It means that there's been enough research and peer-reviewed research by more than one laboratory that shows scientific evidence that this works. And if you go to the National Professional Development Center website, they list the 27 evidence-based practices that have sufficient scientific evidence. What you also see there is not all practices work for all children at all ages in all domains. So something might be academic, something might be social, something might be life skills. So you want to fine-tune the practice to what it is you want to be working on with that child. With that said, evidence-based practice has three components. It's the intersection between scientific evidence, the individual child and family, right? So that's fine-tuning it to the child's profile and age and skill, and also professional expertise for that child. So not everything, there's a lot of parents I hear who say, oh, I've heard that I need applied behavioral analysis. That's the only evidence-based practice out there. That's really not true. There's lots more. It is definitely a very good practice. But I've had children, individual children, who have had very rigid applied behavioral analysis. There's a lot of different applied behavioral analysis. There's a huge spectrum of that. And they've actually become worse. Their behaviors became very angry, and they kicked because they were just tired of someone telling them what to do all the time. Mm-hmm. But so other children in that same situation do wonderfully. So you have to really take it on an individual basis and hopefully have professionals that can help you negotiate.
And it's important that you think about the provider. You know, one doctor practices one way and another doctor practices another way. So ABA therapy is definitely a very evidence-based practice. It has lots of proven results. If practiced the wrong way, it can create some negative things, just like any practice. It can also has been proven to produce a lot of great results, and especially combined with social skills training and some other evidence-based practices, you can really help a kiddo become more functional in his environment.
Have the prognoses improved for people on the autism spectrum, given the proper therapy?
Early identification and intervention, early behavioral developmental intervention for children. And it's sometimes people will say, well, I read 40 hours or I read 25 hours for it, especially for the young kids. It's that many hours of engagement. So it doesn't have to be with a specific therapist. Mm-hmm. So I've done a lot of work with coaching parents. So parents are always working with their kids in their daily routines.
Right? You're talking about hours a week, by the way.
Hours a week. Okay. Yes. Thank mm-hmm. you. I'm sorry. Early intervention has been definitely shown to mitigate the effects of autism, and we get more people with optimal outcome.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have one here from Judy who says, I have a 10-year-old diagnosed with Asperger's pervasive developmental disorder. Are there private schools in the Dallas area that you might suggest, and are they better than, say, a public school would be?
Well, you might find I think it depends on the child's abilities, mm-hmm. And what the family's goals are. There are private schools definitely a good option for some families. You might find a lower ratio. You might find different ways of the classroom management styles. Some of the kiddos will have trouble with organizational skills and time management. And if it's a private school, and there are some in the area that work with children with disabilities, they're more sensitive to those needs and have strategies to help those learners become more independent and better at those skills. One kiddo I can think of right now would forget to turn in papers and forget to not be able to keep his binder organized and that kind of thing. He is now in a school where everything is on the iPad. It's all electronic. So when he does his homework, he just sends it to his teacher. He doesn't have to remember anything the next day, nothing like that. So there's definitely some new, technology has helped with this, and there's definitely some new schools popping up that are helping with our kiddos. But public school is also a good option for many of our kiddos too.
Yeah, it's every school is different, so I can't make a blanket state, right? Private or public, one's better, one's worse. It's really understanding where your child's going to go, what that classroom looks like, whether or not that classroom and that teacher is a good fit for your child. I always tell my parents, it's really not the school, it's the teacher. Mm-hmm. It really comes down to who's going to be interacting with your child. So really knowing what it is that your child needs and then trying to find within your public schools whether or not that's there.
How can we all be good friends to the folks in our communities, our neighborhoods, our families who are growing up with autism?
I think being non-judgmental. When we see kiddos at the grocery store acting up, it may not be that the parent doesn't discipline their child or that they're spoiled. There may be something more going on. And just not to pass judgment and just try to be understanding of others.
And when you're interacting with an individual with autism, especially some of the young ones, sometimes people get nervous, and there's nothing to be nervous about. Mm-hmm. And they feel that when you're nervous, right? And so just to establish trust and just to be there with somebody, you don't have to be interacting to be there with someone and establish trust. And I think that's really important.
Pamela Rollins is Associate Professor in the School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences at the University of Texas at Dallas. Kathy Boatman is a Child Development Specialist and Board Certified Behavior Analyst at Children's Medical Center. She also lectures at the University of Texas at Dallas. April is National Autism Awareness Month. Thank you so much to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.